Well, well, well. What do we have here?
Brand new podcast.
Brand new podcast.
Episode one.
The Impatient Podcast.
The Impatient Podcast.
Welcome, Sean.
Welcome, Nicole. First ever impatient shout out.
Ooh, I love it.
The music you're listening to.
I'm actually digging this tune.
It's a good tune and it's catchy. I've heard it a few times this week and I've hummed it a lot this week.
It has been made by someone who actually knows what they're doing in the world of music, as opposed to us in the world of podcasts.
And it's sort of polar opposites.
Yep. This piece of music was made by a paid professional in the world of music.
Yeah. I mean, not paid by us, but...
Definitely not paid by us.
I'm sure at some point he has been paid. Look,
this music guy, he's legit. Yeah. He is legit. He's far more legit than us. And we want to shout out to Dean Pratt, who's crafted this piece of music. He is also a bowel cancer patient. And we are eternally grateful for the work he's done.
You are a champion.
Dean, thank you.
Thank you, Dean.
Well, we'll get on with it then, I guess.
Segment number one.
Patient life this week. How was your patient life this week?
If I'm honest, pretty good.
Okay.
Granted, my situation is probably a bit more mundane and predictable than yours is.
Mm-hmm.
And while not being without its challenges, this week, pretty good.
That's good.
You?
I do like to say that all patient experiences are relative.
Sure.
My slightly more complicated maybe this week.
Sure.
Yeah, not as great. Bit impatient this week.
On the impatient scale.
On the impatient scale, I'm getting up there.
Yep.
Lung function test this week.
Go on.
This is an off chemo week for me. Had to have a lung function test as a determinant to whether I could, you know, maybe carry on, have access to a couple of different treatment pathways we're considering.
So, just so I understand,
The
outcome of your lung function test
will determine
what your next treatment pathway might be.
Precisely.
Okay.
And I don't know if you've had a lung function test before.
Safely say I never have.
No, okay. They're not the best fun.
Sure.
Particularly when you've had, you know, 6 lung resections. So anyway, here I go. I head on in.
Yeah.
Feeling a little bit anxious.
Yeah.
And participate in the test, which involves kind of blowing into a mouthpiece.
Okay.
And emptying your lungs of all air.
Like expelling as much as you can.
Absolutely, yes. Right. Which is a workout.
Yeah, hard for anyone.
Very hard for anyone. And so I'm getting involved. I'm doing my test. And the technician, as I'm exhaling, his response is, ooh, pretty bad. So that wasn't great feedback.
Probably not the feedback you wanted.
Not mid-test. Nope. I mean, I expected it to be some degree of bad. I mean, I've lost a couple of lobes.
So did he go out? Do you realise the test has started? Like, I need you to blow out all your air, right?
Yeah, that's right. You realise we're actually
like, we're going. This is life. Yeah. We're going now.
This is the test. This is your lung function. Is that all you've got?
Far out.
Okay. So, yeah, look, I mean, you know, he was a bit disinterested. He was a bit, I guess, presuming, looking at my maybe age, height, weight, I don't know, the statistics he had collected prior to commencing the test, which had nothing to do with my health history, but just everything to do with how I presented on the day,
sure.
He expected me to have a slightly more improved lung function
than
I presented with, which, I mean, has kind of left me feeling a little bit anxious. I still don't actually have the official results of that test. Still no results. And that is a little bit anxiety provoking for me this week. So on a scale of patient to impatient, I'm up there this week.
You've got to be leaning impatient based on that.
I'm impatient. A couple of reasons why, as I've detailed.
Justifiable.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
Entirely.
So that's segment one.
I think it's fair to say we nailed that.
Yeah.
Okay, moving on. Segment number two.
Yes.
I've just named it.
Mm-hmm.
Patient stories.
Patient stories. It's a good name because that's what we're doing.
Because it says a lot.
It's quite descriptive, I think. It's quite precise.
Yeah. We have a guest.
We have a fabulous guest, Adam Cabito. Welcome, Adam, and thank you for joining us today. Tell me who you are and how you became a patient.
Thank you, guys. Well, yes, my name's Adam Cabito. I'm 37. I'm an entertainment publicist. I'm a dad to a cavoodle called Walter. I'm also the creator of a cancer awareness brand called Fuck Cancer. And yes, it's because I created it because I was diagnosed with cancer in January 2021. It was actually really interesting the way, or the way I find it, I say it's funny, but it probably wasn't funny. The way I was diagnosed was, you know, 2020 for a lot of people had been pretty rough and certainly like understatement, but we'd all kind of been at home and we'd been, you know, working from home or going through our various challenges. And I just was exhausted and, you know, had completely no energy. So at first I kind of thought that the reason I was feeling so tired and, you know, so beaten down was because of the year that was.
Yeah.
But I realized, you know, a few weeks after finishing work and being on Christmas holidays, this is like December 2019,
mm-hmm.
I was still incredibly tired. So I went and got some blood tests and they really didn't say anything, but I just knew that I didn't feel right. And I had a few doctors around me basically saying, you know, maybe you're just like, you know, you've got some issues with your blood, or maybe you're just a bit, you know, low in iron. And in fact, I got admitted to hospital with anemia. And right. So the doctor said to me, oh, look, you're severely iron deficient. So we're going to admit you to hospital. We're going to give you some iron infusions and some blood transfusions as well.
Yep.
To get your iron back up.
Yep.
And they had been in hospital for a few days and they gave me all the things that they said they were going to do, but I still felt crap and they couldn't really answer it. And they were basically saying, look, I think they actually discharged me from hospital and they said to me, you know what? The doctor actually said to me, go home, have a nice steak. In fact, here's a list of all the items you can eat that have iron in them because you're just obviously not eating enough iron and you just need to go home and focus on that. So I did.
Can I ask a question quickly?
Have
you ever encountered iron deficiency as an issue in your life up until this point?
No, never. And the thing is also, and I say this and I don't mean to offend anyone, but I'm not a vegan, not vegetarian.
Yeah.
But I don't eat a lot of red meat. So, you know, part of me sitting in hospital was thinking to myself, like I was convincing myself, oh, look, maybe they're right. Like maybe I just need to eat more steak and I'm not, you know, or more mushrooms. Like I'm not, you know, doing that. But I'd never encountered iron deficiency or anything like that before.
Yeah.
I'll get to this later, but the reason I sound the way I sound at the moment is I've just found out that I've got COVID too, which is awesome.
Ooh, mic drop moment.
Mic drop moment.
Lucky you. Yeah, great.
I know. I won the national lottery.
Yeah.
the one that no one wants to win.
That's right.
So I genuinely believed them and but I still went home and I still remember the night I got discharged from hospital. I went in and I went to dinner and I ordered everything that had beef in it and just ate it all thinking that somehow that would, you know, fix me.
Fix you. Yeah.
And then still a few weeks later, I was feeling really crap still. And so I followed up with my GP and I asked her to do some tests. And actually, so my mum, she used to be a medical receptionist for a different GP, and he recommended a cancer marker test.
Yeah.
And he said, look, you might as well, like you're doing all these other blood tests, you might as well just add that in just to discount it.
Mm-hmm.
That cancer marker test is what then spurred my GP, so the results that came through, spurred my GP to book a CT scan.
I was going to say, just for context for everyone, a cancer marker test is basically just like an extra couple of words on a blood test form, right? Same.
Basically, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Just a couple of extra characters on a blood test. And it's something that I say to a lot of people now as well, is if you are going to go get a full blood test, or if you're getting a blood test and you feel, you know, that something's up or something's not quite right, just ask them to include that to see, especially if it's covered by bulk billing or it usually is.
Yeah.
Or by your health insurance.
Yeah. Okay. Sorry, back to your CT scan.
No, that's cool. Yeah. So the CT scan, I was lying on the table of the CT scan and I don't even know what they're called, but the person that helps
technician,
you with the CT scan.
Maybe?
Technician, there we go. Yep. Technician, yeah. Yep. Let's go with that. Yeah. So the technician, he said to me, do you have any pain in your stomach? And I said, no. And he said, okay. He goes, I think you should go to your doctor immediately. Okay. But he didn't tell me why? Or anything else. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I guess he was probably doing that because he's probably not qualified to tell me why.
Yep.
But obviously he had seen something. So I went to my GP the next day and she said that there was a dark spot in my stomach near my bowel. So that their suggestion was to book me in for a colonoscopy and a gastroscopy.
Yep.
And so I did that pretty quickly. And that confirmed that they found a tumor in my bowel and my colon.
Mm-hmm.
So things really were moving at a glacial pace, and then all of a sudden things just went into overdrive. Yeah. You know, I found myself a week later being booked in for a major surgery. So I had a right hemicolectomy.
Mm-hmm.
Where they basically, what they do is they take a chunk of your insides, I guess, your colon and your
yep.
bowel, and they take a bit out and then they reconnect it, essentially.
Yep.
But the point is to try and remove the affected area. So my surgeon originally wanted to remove 40% of my bowel, and then ended up removing 70%.
Wow.
So it ended up being quite a big surgery. They also removed a whole bunch of lymph nodes as well. So they originally, again, had only planned to take out a few, and they ended up taking out over 70 lymph nodes. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, it ended up being quite a major surgery, but it was essential for me to sort of, like, tackle this head on.
And so yeah. What happens after surgery? Is there follow-up scans? Is there, like, where were you at in terms of your diagnosis at that point?
Yeah. So at that stage, they weren't able to stage the cancer. So okay. they weren't aware until they had an idea. So I think the few things that surprised me was, especially right after the surgery, the size of the tumor. So mm-hmm. the tumor was about the size of a mandarin,
mm-hmm.
Which when you hold a mandarin, you realize how big that is.
Yeah.
And I think that surprised me to not have felt that or had any inclination that there was anything wrong. The other thing that surprised me about that was the surgeon believed, and my the specialist who did the colonoscopy, they both estimated it to have been there for at least a year, if not 2 years.
Mm.
And so that combined with the size of it was just really shocking to me because, yeah. Like,
so if I can ask pretty direct bowel-related question, because
yeah.
I love poo talk. So there's absolutely. A mandarin sitting in your bowel.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. You didn't feel that, notice that based on your daily bowel habit. There was no inclination of a mandarin in your bowel at that point.
Not at all. And that was, again, surprising. And actually it was a little bit surprising to them too, because mm-hmm. they were saying to me, like, have you, you know, they ran through the list of symptoms or, yep. you know, the usual symptoms. Yep. And, you know, with exception to tiredness, there was no other indicator
yeah.
there.
Yep.
So yeah, everything on the poo front, everything was fine. I mean, you know, obviously we all have bad days, but
yeah.
there was nothing to write home about. That I write home about my bowel movements.
Well, you might.
Well, I do now.
And it's perfectly legitimate to do so. We encourage that on this podcast.
Dear mum.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, shit talking, like, actually. Yeah, I guess fast forward from the surgery, there were more scans, but I pretty much, as soon as I had been deemed to be healed from the surgery, that's when my first round of chemo began.
Yep.
Which was about 2 months after surgery. Yeah.
And so where are you now in terms of that cancer treatment schedule?
Yeah. So basically I did chemo for 6 months,
mm-hmm.
A mix of IV and tablets.
Mm-hmm.
And that produced really, really great results. So they were really happy. I remained sort of clear of any growths, clear of any new new changes or new growths for those 6 months. And then I was put on a 3-month break As my oncologist explained it, he's like, he basically said, you know, when you spray a garden with weed killer, the weeds stop growing. Yep. So now if we stop spraying the weed killer, if the weeds don't grow back, then that's great news.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, the weeds grew back. Mm-hmm. So 3 months later, my CT scan basically showed that there was a new enlarged lymph nodes that were quite large and abnormally large towards my spine in between my kidneys. And then I did a PET scan, which basically confirmed it. So basically that it was back.
Okay.
Yeah. And I had to start a new treatment, which I've just started essentially.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So at that point, you know, that kind of transitions the staging, if you like, doesn't it,
mm-hmm.
of the cancer?
It does. Yes. So my cancer is a stage 4. And it really... obviously we know that stage 4, it's the highest stage. So sounds like in any other thing, it would be a good thing to have reached the highest level, but in cancer it's not at all. I think that's really for me. So again, with that came the revelation that they'd done a bunch of genetic blood tests on me and other testing, and found that I had a BRAF2 mutation. So mm-hmm. It's that mutation that essentially causes the cancer to just find a new home and keep growing again.
Okay.
So that's what this new treatment that I'm on, which is a mix of a chemo again, so a chemo injection, and a trial medication, or not a trial medication, it's a medication called Braftovi. That's the brand name. I'm told that I'm supposed to call it by its real name, which is Encorafenib, and I can never say it.
Oh, it really rolls off the tongue.
Oh, it's just so, yeah. They say, like, don't call it glad wrap. You call it cling film. And I'm like, okay. Okay, cool. So, yeah, it is known as Braftovi on the shelves. It's a drug mainly, as far as I understand, mainly used to treat melanoma, but has shown some success with bowel cancers as well, and it, specifically with people with the BRAF mutation. So, yeah, that's where my oncologist is at the moment.
And is this a, okay, we just keep taking this drug and into perpetuity and just see what happens? Or is there a schedule of a set number of rounds that you need to have?
Yeah, so the current plan, I believe the current treatment will be 6 months in total.
Okay.
The plan, though, was to do 3 months, do another PET scan, another CT scan and a PET scan together.
Mm-hmm.
And then see if it's doing anything. And if it is doing anything at all, they will increase the frequency of it to try and really target it. If it's not doing anything, I don't know. I haven't reached that bridge. But the other spanner that works, which I mentioned earlier, was that last week I got COVID. And so, so as a result, I've now had to pause my chemo.
So not only have you won the highest stage of cancer, but you've also won COVID.
My prize is a disease, another disease. exactly.
This is one of those lotteries where you buy tickets not to participate, I think. That's the...
You're like, who created this lottery? And who can I write to?
But you are, I guess, sorry to interrupt, but what I find kind of staggering about this as... you know, cancer patient myself and someone who's in the, you know, the chats nationally at the moment of the immunocompromised cohort, you know, those poor sick people who might also get COVID, and why we're kind of making decisions and taking steps to protect those people. You are one of those people. We've got one of those people. We've captured them live and we are talking to one of these suppressed minorities who have caught the two prizes of cancer and COVID. So, like, can you bring that to life to us, what that feels like, what has gone through your mind mentally, what it feels like physically?
You know, Nicole, the only way I can describe it at the moment is, so, like, physically feeling, it's a really intense cold. It's a really intense flu. So I am double vaccinated. I was actually due to get my booster shot this week, which I now can't do either. And it, for me, and I maybe, you know, I'm So I guess what my oncologist said to me when I first told him that I just returned a positive test result was that my latest blood tests had shown that I was in a good place in terms of immunity, or in terms of my blood cell count especially.
Yep.
So maybe I'm not experiencing the full experiences that someone who is immune suppressed like me would go through. But at the moment, it's essentially like a really, really intense flu that hits you all at once. And I guess the interesting thing for me is, you know, having gone or still going through, going through cancer, you know, these feelings of tiredness and fevers and bone aches are nothing new to me. Yeah. So maybe I haven't felt the hit as hard because I've been hit constantly for the last, you know, 12 to 14 months. That's the way I'm feeling at the moment.
Yeah.
So that's the physical feeling. The mental feeling is a bit of a different one because I've done everything in my power, you know, to avoid this. And, you know, I barely go anywhere. And in particular, when the cases in New South Wales and Victoria, because I split my time between both states, when the case numbers were getting so big in both, I just went into complete shutdown mode. You know, I've seen no friends and I've seen some core family, but I've seen no friends and family beyond that. I've gone nowhere. I've traveled nowhere. And I've completely changed my life to sort of cotton wrap myself because it's so essential. So mentally, it's really incredibly frustrating and depressing.
So you don't know where you caught it, obviously.
No idea. And it really, you know, if someone was asking me, like, did you do everything by the books? I absolutely did.
Yeah.
You know, from mask wearing to hand washing to hand sanitizer. So, you know, and you know, obviously, my guess is right now is it was while I was getting some groceries or while I was at the post office, because that's the only two places I've actually been in the last 2 weeks.
Has this impacted your treatment schedule? Like, what? How are we sitting that way?
Yeah. So, I guess the first impact or the biggest impact is I was I returned a positive result the day before I was due to go in for chemo.
Okay.
So, chemo is now delayed by a minimum of 2 weeks. That bit scares me. So,
yeah.
You know, knowing how quickly things can change.
Can you walk me through, because obviously, you know, we're talking about out in the community at the moment, if you've got COVID, you just kind of go sit in a room by yourself for 7 days and then you're free of COVID, you know? What is the thinking around the 2 week delay?
Yeah, that's a good question. So the way it was explained to me was that you are considered within 7 days, if you're asymptomatic after 7 days, or you're not displaying any of the core symptoms, which was, you know, cough, sneeze, runny nose, or extreme lethargy, that you're free to return back into society. Not that I will anyway.
Yeah.
I think my oncologist is giving me an extra week on top of that to get my body back a bit because, as he described it, you know, and in theory, I might have been able to actually do chemo if I could have found a medical venue that would have allowed me to do it as a COVID positive patient. But the two hospitals that I go to normally wouldn't allow me to because they didn't have the facilities to be able to administer the chemo in a safe space for the medical staff as well.
It's so interesting, isn't it? Because we can find safe spaces to treat COVID positive patients, but we can't find safe spaces to treat COVID positive cancer patients.
Exactly. And so that was a real surprising one for me. So they basically have said, and essentially they don't want to introduce two things attacking my immune system at the same time. So COVID's a really thing and a bang up job of that.
Yep.
So if you then put cetuximab or whatever it's called in the mix, then you'd basically just, you know, a glutton for punishment. So I think that's the reasoning behind the 2 weeks, but they did say that at the end of next week, which is when I'm due to clear my 2 weeks, that they'll assess whether I'll need to delay even further. And again, it's all these things that scare me. So I've gone into this, you know, hyperdrive of, you know, eating every cough lolly and syrup and everything and vitamin C and D and A and E that I can have because I really want to pass the test so that I can get chemo again.
Yeah.
Like it. Yeah.
Yeah, I relate to that feeling of, please sir, can I have my drugs?
Yeah. I know. I lied this whole time, this whole treatment time, and then pre-COVID as well, I have said to my medical care team, whatever you need me to do or whatever I need to do, I will do. So, if this helps me get better or feel better,
yeah,
then I will do anything and everything. Mm. I'm the same with COVID at the moment. I'm just like, okay, how do I get this bastard out of me, because I want to go back to the other bastard, chemo, and I'm happy with one, but I don't want both.
No.
So at the moment I'm in delay.
Well, it's a lot.
Really? Yeah, it's a lot. You know what I'm saying is, like, I'm suppressed and depressed because, like, it's
I laugh, but I love the way you put that. Yeah. That describes it so well.
Yeah, I mean, the whole way, this whole thing, it's not in anyone's book. You don't want cancer, no one wants cancer, but you never think it's going to be part of your life. And when it is part of your life, the only way that I've been able to address it is to speak about it candidly.
Yep.
Because even though it's incredibly, well, my experience, and I'm sure shared by a lot of people, it's upsetting and it's frightening and it's scary, but I've sort of tried to dehumanize it as much as possible to try and, speaking candidly about it, like it's a terrible tenant that you want to evict, is how I deal with it.
But it's that's obviously something that is assisting you from a mental health perspective and processing it. But it's also such a powerful thing for other people. Mm. It's a real tick box in, taking steps for humanity, like I think that's such an admirable thing to be able to do that. It's funny, I don't want that to sound cliche because moving in patient advocacy circles, hear that kind of stuff sometimes and you think, awkward, thanks, but awkward. But I just think, just sitting here talking to you about the reality of having to, live with this disease that everyone in the world has spoken about for, 2 years now, and then also having to live with a disease that has kind of fallen off the radar and people aren't speaking about enough, and to do that, publicly and to share that with us, I think is massive. But I also think maybe at this point we should sidebar, talk about Walter or something, just to bring the energy up,
You know what? He's sitting here giving me the craziest side eye. He gets very jealous.
Walter does have a bit of a Instagram presence, I've noticed.
He does. Yeah.
As does your shop, which I want to mention as well. Mm. Can you take us through what you're doing there?
Yeah. So fuck cancer. And speaking as a general sentiment, but that's also the brand name.
Yeah.
I created that literally a week before starting chemo, because and speaking about that, the way I deal with things and speaking candidly about it has helped me. Creating for cancer was a way for me to deal with everything I was going through. Mm. And, I wanted it to be the one thing that I found at that time. And look, I'm 37. I'm not. Youth, but like I'm also not over 50, and I was reading a lot at the time of my diagnosis. I Googled everything, and read every book I could read. I did, and a lot of the language that I was finding was targeted towards elderly people or over 50s in particular, and not being an ageist at all, but nothing for me was really presented, or I couldn't find anything really that I wanted that was really helping me understand it or sort of spoke in a tone that I wanted to speak about it. I basically wanted, I wanted to give myself, but also anybody else that wanted to come along for the ride, permission to go, this is not a great experience and no one should go through this.
Mm. I relate to this so much, just when you think about bowel cancer by itself, right? We're just seeing this, really significant increase in the number of young people who are diagnosed with bowel cancer. And yet all of this talk around the bowel symptoms that you find when you're going to experience bowel cancer. And of course, I'm talking to you who, you know, really didn't experience those bowel symptoms. And I'm talking as a patient who also didn't experience those symptoms. So, there's got to be a change in conversation.
And you know what? And I hate to say this, no cancer is a competition.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, bowel cancer is also not a sexy cancer in that respect, that it doesn't get the airtime that a lot of the other cancers do. And it's not to throw any shade to anybody else going through any other type of cancer.
Yeah.
It's more a commentary on PR, which is kind of funny because it's my world.
That's your world, So this is your fault, really, Adam. So I think lift your game. That's my takeaway from the podcast.
Thank you. Yeah, try harder. That's exactly it. It's all my fault. No, it's true. It really doesn't get the share of voice that a lot of the others do. And so that was also a reason for me to create the brand, because I just wanted to give people, an outlet, essentially. And to also not view cancer, like, cancer is scary, and it is very medical and very, clinical and very sterile a lot of the times. So, like, why not treat it with that MTV, style? I mean, the first thing I did when I launched Fuck Cancer was I went on my friend Ash London. She hosted a music, 7 to 10 p.m. music show on a national radio network. I did an interview about bowel cancer on her show. She had never done an interview about bowel cancer in a music show.
And
so I'm like, well, actually, why don't we treat it with that? Why don't we treat it, like an album release or like a new show? Like, get everyone to talk about it. And especially for younger people to understand, and I'm one of them who didn't have any of the usual typical symptoms. To know that if you just don't feel well and you do feel a bit crap, that, go speak to your doctor and ask for the test. Like, it's, we're lucky that we live, a lot of us, live with access to free medical care or discounted medical care. So take advantage of that.
Yep. It's a very empowering message and totally awesome. I'm a fan. I like you a lot. Can I just say that, Adam? I really like you.
Oh, I like you too. You know what, Nicole? I have to give you credit. You have been like someone who had never experienced cancer firsthand at all.
Yeah.
Your account was one of the first that I stumbled upon, and just seeing your stories and hearing you just sharing everything openly and honestly actually inspired me to do it too. Because it's true. Like, even though I'm a publicist and I'll gladly talk about anyone, talking about myself is something I don't do.
Yeah.
And it really encouraged me to just share my stories and share what I was going through and take photos of, the crap that you've got to drink or the scans you've got to go through, or, the way you feel today, or the way you look today. I was going on Instagram and showing people my, scaly skin that I was getting as a result of the chemo. And, and I would never have done that in the past. But your account and a few others like you, you just openly share your journey because it helps inform people and educate people more than any, book
just,
or journal
ever does. Totally. Just a lived experience, right? Like, that's what Instagram is, just a lived experience. Just
that's it.
Our days happen to be slightly different than standard. Shawnee, anything to add?
One of the things that blows my mind the most here is that, like, pre-diagnosis, going through, that extreme fatigue and just wanting to find answers, there is this idea that, your symptoms are your fault. You're tired. You're iron deficient, probably just go eat a steak. Solve your problem.
Yeah.
Like, that blows my mind.
Mm. It blew my mind too. And actually, again, I keep saying kind of funny, but it's not the right word to say. I was in hospital recovering from my hemicolectomy a month later. And that's literally a month, 4 weeks later compared to when I was previously in hospital being told, being discharged and being told to go home and eat a steak. And the doctor who actually said that line, go home and eat a steak, he was walking in the ward and he saw me in bed and he stopped at my bed and my parents were there. And he said, oh, he goes, I'm really sorry, but you look really familiar and I can't work out why. And I said, oh, yeah, because I actually saw you a few weeks ago. And he goes, oh, why are you here? Like, why are you in this particular ward? And I said, oh, because I've just had a major, you know, hemicolectomy surgery and I'm recovering because they found a tumor. And he literally went white. Like, he was a younger doctor. He went white and he said, I'm so sorry that I didn't do any tests while you were in here already. I mean, not that really, you know, 3 weeks really would have made a difference, like in the scheme of things, but he genuinely was kind of shocked. And it was a real surprise for me because, you know, yeah, I was in hospital and it obviously was sort of dismissed as something else. And I wonder how many other young people, not necessarily at the hospital level, because that obviously requires, you know, you to be feeling really, really bad. But I just wonder how many young people get their concerns dismissed.
Yeah, certainly at the GP level.
That's what I think. And I wonder that. And that really scares me. So that's why I think the more we talk about it as patients, the more important it is.
Yep, definitely. Sorry, just need to cough myself. Ooh, COVID. No, just got my PCR back. Got my PCR back. I'm good. I'm in a huddle with my isolating group. I'm all good.
Yes. You do that. You stay covered.
Yeah, that's right. You go nowhere.
Don't go to the post office.
Yeah, I'm never going to the post office again. I'm just post office is off the list.
That's it.
Last question. Thinking about our entire health system and your experience of it, can you give me something that is broken, something that is working, and something that the entire system needs to hear right now?
You know, that's a big question.
Yeah, ask me a simple question, Nicole.
Can we just go back to talking about my dog?
Yeah, that's right.
Something that's broken. Look, I think I'm probably going to say this because of my career. I think something that's broken, I believe, is communication.
Yep.
And look, I hope my oncologist isn't listening, but I have said to him before, you know, I really wish I could teach you how to speak to people in a better way, because, and I think it's because I am like literally my whole career has been based on speaking to people. So I think when I hear someone talk to me, I analyze it at a different level, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I think communication really, the way we're spoken to throughout our whole experience, there are some people that are brilliant at it and there are some people that just really need to learn. You know, we call it bedside manner, right, doctors? Yeah. But there are some doctors that say some things and it can make you feel a whole lot worse. And if you aren't a strong person, you know, mentally especially, that can really impact you and can make you feel really bad. There are certain, I say this to everybody, and it's understand the power that you assign to words.
Completely.
And there are some words that they say that people have said to me, medical people have said to me, that if I wasn't a stronger person, it would have completely crushed me.
And people don't necessarily understand that then, you know, if you are crushed, that means that you're like, you know what, this week I can't do chemo, you know, or you're not up to it mentally or emotionally. And then that can impact your outcomes, right? That can that could be the difference between whether this treatment makes something operable or inoperable, you know, like that's, people don't necessarily appreciate the flow-on effect of language, I think.
Exactly. Yeah, so that's a big one for me. I mean, something that's working is a hard one because, you know, I think, and again, I guess it's based on personal experience, but I think the way we're in Australia, we're obviously lucky to have access to, you know, a healthcare system that a lot of other countries don't.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think, you know, for me, that's the good thing because, you know, I have never really been the sort of person to go to a doctor regularly.
Yeah.
And I've spent more time in doctor's offices in the last year than I think I have in my whole life, to be honest, because I feel like I've been in and out of hospitals and surgeries and rooms, you know. So I think for me, I think our hospital system and our medical system, I think we're pretty fortunate to have access to it.
Yeah.
I still think it can obviously be better, obviously, but, you know, and I think they've been under incredible strain with something like COVID as well to deal with as a constant. But I think, you know, I think our treatments are working, or at least our access to treatments is something that is working.
Yeah. Okay.
And something that the entire system needs to hear right now. You know what? It probably goes back to my first point. Patients aren't just patients. They are people. They're humans.
Mm-hmm.
And really, they're humans going through human things. And I think, again, back to that point about communication, I just implore, especially medical professionals, to remember that I know that they, obviously, so that they don't go insane themselves, you know, need to remain a bit clinical about it, but just remember that you're speaking to another human who's going through a lot.
Yeah,
I think there's a middle ground. I don't think there has been a lot of times where I felt like a number, or you know, like a, you know, a cog in a machine, and yeah, that doesn't feel good, and it doesn't help me get better. Part of my treatment, you know, I've got to sit there and wait for my oncologist in a room, in a waiting room, where I literally get a printed receipt with a number on it, and they call my number out like I'm standing at, you know, the motor registry.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't, it just removes the human from it completely.
Yeah.
So yeah. Is there a way we can humanize it a bit more? I mean, I know there's a real reason to get that number on a docket, but I just get angry at it every time. I'm
completely,
like, I'm not number 657.
Yeah.
I'm Adam.
I'm Adam, you know, completely. Like, yeah. And there's a process reason, and then there's all these bureaucratic reasons. Oh, we don't want to say,
sure.
I don't know, Adam out loud to protect your privacy. But really, again, you know, I so often I go, you know, through this process with organizations or whatever, you know, in my capacity as a management consultant, and we sort of will talk about, oh, you know, how do we improve this? How do we do this better? How do we, you know, we want to make this more patient-centered. And my response overwhelmingly to that question is, well, have you asked the patient what they want?
Yes.
You know, and the patient doesn't want to be a number, even if on paper privacy principles say that that might be the best way to approach it, or process improvement principles say that numbers are more efficient, or, you know, whatever the case may be. If we want to look after the patient, and that's something that's an overriding principle in healthcare, you know, in 2022 is to be patient-centered. Have we asked the patient?
You know, I did ask that question, you know, one particular day when probably the steroids were working overtime. and I was pretty angry. And I did say, like, why am I the same number every time? Why can't you just call out my name? Especially because it's the same person every time.
Mm.
And the lady behind the desk, she's lovely, but she said to me, oh, yeah, it is a patient confidentiality thing.
Yep.
But then takes me over to a weighing station and weighs me in front of everybody and reads out my weight. And I'm like, okay, cool. Well,
yeah, right. Okay.
So that, yeah, you can't call me Adam, but you can read out my weight in front of 30 people. That's
but cool. I can't identify you based on your weight.
Maybe you should make your weight your number that they call out. That would be really
good. I should. That's it. Well, look, it isn't 657, but
well, not yet, and not with an attitude like that, Adam. You could work at it, and it could be.
That's it.
All right. Well, this has been an awesome chat. I have thoroughly enjoyed the conversation, but I really am also just so grateful for, you know, your vulnerability here. Your, you know, just publicly sharing just your truth in terms of, you know, what this is actually like to be a patient, and some of the insights and also improvement opportunities that you have very openly shared. And I really hope that the whole system is listening to the opportunities for improvement that you have identified today. Thank you, Adam, for being here.
Thank you. Thank you for the opportunity.
Adam truly is amazing, like in every sense of the word.
Yeah, I mean, I think we've outdone ourselves on guest number one.
Yeah, strong guest one.
Let's take 100% of the credit for that.
Yeah.
Now, on Adam, I've got a couple of things I want to say.
Go on.
number one, what a champion. This is a person using their experience, really tough experience, cancer experience, to make things clearer, make things better for everybody else. And I think despite the fact that he's in active treatment, despite the fact that he's going through so much himself, including COVID, he is a champion for messaging around cancer and just communicating with people in his age group who are like him and identifying the requirement there. And I think that's so admirable. He's so damn likable and he has a dog with a great dog name. And is there a better guest for episode number one? No, there's not.
We have set the bar high.
But there are some other things I want to say on this discussion. And point number two, a little bit of a firmer point.
Go on.
I would like to make. We know that the epidemiology of bowel cancer is changing, right? The presentation of bowel cancer in our population in Australia is evolving. Mm-hmm. We know that, right? The new cases of bowel cancer in people under 50 are on the rise.
Right.
That is a fact. We know that. We know this. Doctors know this. Researchers know this. Governments know this. So this dismissal that Adam faced is inexcusable, frankly, in terms of the presentation of his disease in the first place, particularly because we know that it's this dismissal of patients, particularly at the GP level, that is actively contributing to the delay in a diagnosis. And that means that more young people are presenting with advanced cancer than needs to, right? Because if we don't catch it when it first presents, it just advances, right? And we move through the stages to stage four, just as Adam found himself. And that's where we're more likely to face agonizing treatments in order to stay alive or ultimately die. That's where we're at. That's what stage four cancer is. And we know that. And that's the real life situation here. And I just feel like we need accountability. We need the system to own this change, this evolution in the way that bowel cancer is presenting in our population and own its mistakes as a driver for improvement, right? So the next Australian stage four bowel cancer patient is sitting in a GP right now with questions that aren't being answered. And we need to acknowledge that.
If you're going to announce to the world that early detection in this stuff is critical,
yes,
then the system needs to allow for early detection of this stuff, right?
Completely. And there are so many diagnostic tools that we can use to find bowel cancer. And really, for a young population like myself, like Adam, in this cohort of people under 50, we're literally saying to this cohort of people, we know there's an increase in cancer happening in your age group. We don't really understand the factors why. We need you to keep a lookout because we're not screening you for it. We know that this is, of all of the cancers that this cohort, this population of young people, young people will face, it's the deadliest cancer there. And I just feel like, you know, I just really feel like I'm hoping that some decision makers in this space are listening and understanding that this delay in diagnosis and misdiagnosing bowel cancer is a consistent problem. It happened to me, it happened to Adam, it's happened to so many people, and I really want to call that out.
At the fault of the system.
Yes, the system. And so often of the actual doctors, the practitioners, the people who stand between you and a treatment. That's point number two on Adam. Point number three
is, let me ask, point number two, heavier than point number one.
That's right.
Which direction are we going from here?
Point number three is more of an observation.
Go on.
That we have both had, I think, in reflecting on the interview with Adam. And it's kind of the reason, the purpose for guest number two on our podcast. So let's unpack this. Language matters. Words matter. And the function of words in assigning ownership of a problem, that matters too. So this is a guy who had a serious health problem, potentially a legitimate internal bleed because of the way that his anemia is presenting.
Sure.
In terms of being admitted to hospital. And he's being told by medical professionals to just go and eat meat.
Yeah. Eat a steak about it. You'll be fine.
And like, so ironically, in the context of bowel cancer, meat's a contributing factor in terms of lifestyle choices. Oh, sorry.
When I said go eat meat, I didn't mean eat meat.
Wow, wow, wow. So not only are we ignoring the diagnostic imperative in front of us, But then we're actually blaming the patient and we're using language that transfers guilt and blame. And I would describe that as a really strong patient communication strategy.
Look, if you were going to write the book, Patient Communication Strategies 101.
That is not it.
Blame the patient.
And Adam has so many examples of the impact of language and how we need to think before we speak in healthcare across every part of his diagnosis and treatment experience. He has examples, right? And so I think for you and I, based on that conversation in the chats that we've had, we said, well, really, segment three is about, like, let's ask some of these questions to someone who actually knows what they're doing here.
Yeah.
Someone who takes this on as their daily job.
Yeah.
Someone who communicates about cancer in our system.
Lovely segue to Joni.
Joni Thomas.
Joni is probably best described as a communications expert.
Mm-hmm.
She's a published writer. She's a public speaker. She's a trainer and facilitator, just an overall communications specialist. She's worked across multiple industries, but at present works in healthcare.
She does. Joni has entered the group chat.
Hello.
Now, we have joked with Adam that he's underperforming in the PR campaign for bowel cancer, but you've actually taken this on. Can you walk us through the realities of communicating about bowel cancer?
Look, I think there are a couple of things when considering that question. First up, bowel cancer is such a complex disease in terms of the fact that it's not any longer something you can isolate to older people. So there's bowel cancer and then there's young onset bowel cancer. So in a way, you're talking about two different diseases. You're definitely talking about two very different audiences. And so when you start talking about communications, that's a big challenge. You're also looking at a multicultural society in Australia, but bowel cancer, it's not some simple communication strategy when you look at it. So my experience, you know, from the very beginning has been, who are we trying to talk to when we're communicating a message?
Yeah.
And when I say we, I'm talking about Bowel Cancer Australia, where I spent 6+ years. And Bowel Cancer Australia was really focusing on the continuum of care. So it was across from, you know, prevention all the way to end of life. And it was looking at both the traditional bowel cancer, but increasingly young onset bowel cancer. And so, you know, again, you would just see this fragmentation because we had to say, okay, this demographic, this population needs this message. So if you're somebody who has no exposure to bowel cancer, you have no family history, you have potentially no life style risk factors, what is the message that's going to speak to you, right? On the other end of it, then we're talking about kind of prevention and awareness in this category. But for somebody who has a family history, maybe their dad or their granddad or their uncle had bowel cancer, then already the message needs to be different because they're at a higher level of risk. They need to know what they should be looking out for, and they need to know that they should be having a conversation with their GP a lot earlier than 50. Right? Because we know from medical science that actually they should be going in and talking to their GP about their risk 10 years earlier than would have been the case for whenever their father, like I say, or their mother had bowel cancer. It's just something, because you want to catch bowel cancer early. So I'm not sure if I'm sticking with the basic train of thought of the realities of communicating about bowel cancer, but just to give you an idea that you've already got different audiences, you've got different kinds of messages. But then I'm just going to add a little extra to it, and that is the semantics involved. Because I don't think people think about this, but I've run into this so frequently, especially lately, as we have more and more international campaigns, and we have more and more young people who are looking for answers, looking for other people like them, and going and looking at websites in the US, in Canada, in the UK. And I don't know if you've seen it or not, but I'm guessing you have. Bowel cancer is not the word used to describe colon cancer or colorectal cancer. It's the same thing, brain. Mm-hmm. So it's literally a semantics issue. And then also, if you go in and you talk to your doctor or your oncologist, they're going to say colorectal cancer. You have a colorectal surgeon. So again, there's a break in the communication that is challenging.
Yep.
So that's just a start. That's just a little taste of some of the realities of communicating about bowel cancer. If you want to dive into a particular area, please, I turn it back to you.
I'm struck by a couple of things that you've said there. I think the fragmentation is a word that really resonates with me, having had that conversation with Adam and understood, you know, how much he felt that his, you know, specific experience wasn't captured, wasn't understood. And arguably it is an emerging issue, you know, this idea of the fact that young people can get bowel cancer and it's not just an old person's disease. And then further than that, you know, the fact that we then have to acknowledge that, okay, well, if young people can get bowel cancer, well, then how do they need to be spoken to? And is this an issue of prevention or is this an issue of, you know, upskilling and informing the wider health community about the realities of this? And that kind of leads to that point that you're just making about the semantics of this, and it reminds me of the comment that Adam made about the power of language and the fact that, you know, words mean so much. And in a really cluttered health landscape, when, you know, someone as a patient is just trying to, you know, even unpack their own disease, or someone who is not a patient but who is at risk or potentially is about to be a patient just has no idea about the difference or similarity of, you know, bowel cancer, colorectal cancer, why we have these, you know, two different approaches to it, and the hurdles that are created just via language.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. I mean, it's the conversation, right? So I've spoken to people across the sector about this, and, you know, people working in pathology and screening, to healthcare professionals like nurses and GPs, and of course to patients. And in my mind, you know, it seems like we need to stop talking about bowel cancer and start talking about bowel health. You know, it's that subtle shift, kind of like what we've been seeing happen in the mental health space, right? So rather than talking about mental illness, we're talking about mental health. People are afraid of cancer. They don't want to talk about it until it's personal. And then, you know, it becomes a central part of every conversation. But it's not out of choice. Yep. People don't go running around wanting to talk about cancer. And I thought it was hilarious when Adam was talking to his, about his dog and how his dog is sick of him talking about it. And he said, you know, look, man, I want to talk about it too, as soon as I can, right? It's an uncomfortable conversation. And I will say, I know that so many bowel cancer patients that I speak to say, look, you know, it's especially hard because it's bowel cancer. And I absolutely hear that. You know, it's one of the most common, and yet it doesn't get the same airtime as prostate or breast, or even, you know, ovarian, skin. All of these are people seem a little bit more comfortable. But I assure you that cancer is cancer. And as you probably have experienced, people get uncomfortable with topic, you know, a topic that is something that's kind of out of their control. What do they say about it? And I think most people would choose never to speak about it again, you know, once they've had it, gotten through treatment, they're on the other side. So I think, you know, if you talk about bowel health, and I think that when you start looking at it from the perspective of overall health, and the bowel is one part of that, then it becomes more of a habit. It becomes less confrontational. It becomes a wellness exercise rather than a cancer scary thing. You know what I mean?
Yes. 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 And this is something that I rant on about constantly, is that we need to be having more whole of body health conversations rather than just the disaster of cancer. One thing that that I'm just sort of reflecting on it as you're talking, mm-hmm. is this kind of this problem with language and why we have, you know, colorectal cancer on one end and bowel cancer on the other end. And if that was just a, you know, a delineation that happened because of countries, you know, we could understand that. Mm-hmm. But that's happening right here in our own country. Mm-hmm. From your perspective, who's in charge of that? Why can't we just get together as a group of informed health professionals and say, right, from now on, we're going with bowel cancer, or from now on, we're going with colorectal cancer, and just make a call on that and move on? What's your impression of that?
Oh, wow. You know, that is actually something I have had conversations about, and that it's tricky. It is really tricky. To be honest with you, I think that really, quite honestly, would require almost a roundtable event, bringing the government and the healthcare professionals and the charity sector into the same room and having a conversation and saying, mm-hmm. you know, what purpose does it serve to be calling it something different when we're talking to consumer yep. media and patients? Well, patients here, I believe patients are hearing colorectal or colon or rectal. I don't think that their doctor is talking about mm-hmm. bowel cancer necessarily. I don't know. What was your experience there? Were they talking to you as if it were bowel cancer? Were they saying, what were you seeing on your charts? What were you seeing in your notes?
So I am seeing colorectal cancer whenever there is a formal medical communication. Mm-hmm. So whenever we're talking, you know, to a surgeon, or whenever we're talking to a radiologist, or wherever we're talking to someone else, but I am seeing a conversation with my oncologist, I guess, about bowel cancer. So when they turn to communicate to me as the patient, I'm kind of remembering back through all of my conversations, doctor to patient, it's been bowel cancer. Okay. But then as we kind of turn and go, okay, well, let's have a conversation that's now medical with all the experts, then we switch to colorectal cancer. And I think that it just that kind of, you know, just putting up a wall between, well, we talk about, you know, a nice friendly conversation about a bowel when we're talking to a patient, because a bowel is a little bit more palatable perhaps than the combination of a colon and a rectum and a, you know, or a rectal cancer, which, you know, oh, by the way, is actually a bottom, and, you know, whereas a colon is kind of still a bowel is still inside you somehow, so it's not as offensive. I don't know, but that was definitely a separation that I have seen. So when we're trying to be warm and fuzzy and attract, you know, the general public and patients ultimately to the conversation about bowel cancer, then it's a bowel. But whenever we're having an actual expert medical conversation, which is a huge problem because that generates this kind of lack of ownership and attachment for the patient to their actual medical journey and all of the, you know, the real conversations that are happening with the experts and the decision makers.
One of the things that I've found through my experience working like in emergency health, I guess, is that the general public don't have the same level of knowledge with regard to this stuff that anybody with even a modicum of understanding of health do. And there is an assumption that everyone knows that there's that bowel and colorectal mean the same thing. And I think that a large percentage of the population would not know that.
So I absolutely love that you're saying this, and I really hope that people are hearing this, because I completely agree with you. I mean, in case you can't tell, because I know I have an amazingly assimilated Australian accent, but I actually grew up in America. So first time I ever heard bowel was here, and I've really never understood why bowel is inserted in this space. And it's funny you call it kind of warm and fuzzy. I don't see bowel as any, you know, any more warm and fuzzy than colorectal or colon or rectal.
No.
And, you know, when I was a baby, when I was not a baby necessarily, but when I was younger, I had a babysitter who used to talk about bowel movements. And I used to think, what is she talking about? Right. I mean, it just was like, she was trying to be polite. She didn't want to say, do you need to go to the toilet? Mm-hmm. Or it was the whole poo-poo, pee-pee thing. She was going for a little bit more elevated than that. But really, bowel, that's such a rare word when talked about in the U.S. Now here, it's just part of everyday discussion, hardly. It's part of discussion when you're talking about bowel cancer and you work in the space. But like you say, I think, Sean, your point is absolutely correct that people don't necessarily make that connection. And I think that that's probably one of my greatest frustrations. As I said, you know, it's semantics. It's something so simple. But words, as Adam highlighted, they have power and they can be incredibly confusing. And this comes back to health literacy. You know, health literacy is so poor anyway. So ideally, with any comm strategy, you want to be clear, you want to be consistent. And in my opinion, you know, having something called the national, and then maybe this is part of the problem, a national bowel cancer screening program. So first up, you've got bowel in the word, right? So what are they going to call it? A national colorectal screening program? They could, but they're going to have to change that program. That's a lot of money on packaging. I mean, that's just an outside conversation, but it's just a comment. The other thing about that program, though, again, coming back to semantics, is it's actually not a national bowel cancer screening program. It's actually a national bowel screening program because it's not screening for cancer. Yes. It's screening for blood, which could be indicative of cancer, but it could also be indicative of a bunch of other things, right? So again, coming back to your original question about the complexities around communicating about bowel cancer, first of all, we have a word that is not necessarily understood or recognized across, well, it's certainly not the same word used across the different stakeholder groups. And this is also in pharma, I can tell you, you know, when pharma wants to do a launch about a drug that's going to be making a huge difference for patients, the terminology, at least for the healthcare sector, is going to be talking about colorectal cancer. But when we find more patients, it's going to talk about bowel cancer. So, I mean, really, there's a disconnect there. And then there's the disconnect of, you know, just talking about the health versus the cancer, and getting people just to be familiar with the organ, whatever you want to call it, but being consistent about it.
Yes.
You know, let's all call it the same thing, whatever it's going to be. And it doesn't have to be a universal approach, as in we all have to call it the same thing as America, but can we at least all in Australia agree to call it one thing? That would be a start.
Yep.
You know, unfortunately, I have not made a lot of progress in that area. And I'm not sure.
You are also underperforming in the role, so I think we need a new expert.
Adam and I are going to have to go sit in the little not qualified corner. Bring the next guest on. I will continue to listen with big ears. Sean, maybe you.
Look, I'm not willing to take on the role, if I'm honest. It's not for me.
So, Jenny, how much time, effort, money goes into these communications campaigns to the patient versus how much time, effort, money goes into a communications campaign directly to a doctor? Do you, as a PR person, as a PR professional, are you getting involved in crafting these messages to doctors as the intended end user or audience?
So me personally, I have in the past. But, you know, so that's the whole health education side, right? So when you talk about health, there's all sorts of elements. Marketing and PR are just part of it, but there's health education, there's health advocacy, so on and so forth. And the health education part really is focusing on, you know, educating those audiences, including healthcare practitioners about different topics. So, yes, I mean, one of the, as an example, you know, there's, well, I won't say the publication, I guess I could, but there's an oncology publication that, again, that you featured in, but I've written articles for, and that kind of comms, the messages there are, you know, it's clearly a different target audience, but a lot of oncologists are unaware of new treatments. I mean, I shouldn't say a lot, but there are new treatments on the horizon. Now, you can imagine as an oncologist, they're very busy working on a range of things. They're trying to save lives on a daily basis. Mm-hmm. In terms of the patients that they're dealing with. So they're certainly going to be across different things, but you know, the more information you can give them in a succinct and clear way, as early as possible, the better. So I've definitely been involved in that. And I think that that's a really critical piece to the overall awareness about, again, coming back to bowel cancer. You know, it's one of the issues that comes up so much, and I think Adam probably mentioned it, I've definitely heard it from so many other patients as well, and that is, you know, you go and you sit in front of a GP, and the person they see in front of them is young, and so they're not thinking bowel cancer. So what does that say? that says GPs need a major awareness campaign. They need to be educated about the fact that bowel cancer is affecting people of all ages and actually is the deadliest cancer for people between the ages of 25 and 44 here in Australia. It's a really tragic statistic that does not need to be that way. And so GP awareness, healthcare professional awareness, critical. And yes, that's a part of it. When you come to the money and where's the money going, you know, pharma industry, they want to obviously educate the clinicians about new products, right? Because they want those products to be prescribed and made available to patients that can benefit from them. So there is education happening there, typically through trade publications. It's through research, it's through conferences,
but this does come with its own set of complications, right? Because as soon as we introduce a conversation about pharma, then there's a conversation about, well, conflict of interest, and you know, pharma's only involved because they want to sell their particular drug, and people get quite passionate about that issue quite quickly, don't they?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. I would challenge that based on my experience with pharma. I know pharma has a really bad reputation, or at least it has in the past. I think, you know, I would certainly not defend everything that pharma has done in the past. But again, I think that there are bad apples, and I think you can see that in any industry. I think that the people I've met over the years here in Australia largely want to make a difference, a positive difference in the lives of patients. You know, they're not, it's funny. I just, my experience has been genuinely positive. And I think the thing that frustrates me comes down to negotiating between government and pharma. Because naturally, you know, I'm all about the patient and I want to see the patient get access to treatment. And I don't really care about the cost. I just want to see it happen as soon as possible. But the reality in a universal healthcare system is that that's not feasible, right? I mean, it is possibly, but we have a ways to go in terms of figuring out how that's going to work. So I think, you know, it is a balance. And I think that it's really important, again, coming back to comms and patient and health communications, specifically, you know, there are a lot of people out there trying to do good work, and especially in the not-for-profit sector, but there's very little funding. And so there is a lot of potential for, you know, bad actors to go in there and take advantage of situations. And that's where, you know, it's essential that you do have people that are trained in terms of communications, in terms of business, in terms of advocacy, and in terms of risk, that are really looking at the messaging, ensuring that it's credible, ensuring that it's evidence-based, ensuring that it is well-rounded. Because that's the other thing, you know, when we talk about what are the critical elements of, you know, a health communications strategy and everything, you really need to make sure that you're talking truth, that you're considering all sides, that you're considering all audiences. Because if you're not, then it's not going to be balanced. You need to be looking at those risks and benefits, right? I mean, there's just so many things that are critical that when you start talking about patient comms or health comms, and you're looking at little startups that are desperate for funding, there is the potential for misinformation.
Oh, I just look. Okay. So when we had this idea of the Inpatient Podcast, we were going to go to the expert for the answer.
Yeah,
I feel like we've just got more questions, really.
Can of worms.
I just think that there's so much that we have covered off on in this conversation that is so important. And, you know, I think Adam's experience it is just one story and is just one insight into the power of language, into the role of communication as a human across, you know, every facet of the patient experience. And I think that that's something that, you know, if there was sort of one thing that was a takeaway for me in the conversation with him, you know, he's a he's a marketing and PR professional himself, you know. Mm-hmm. And in marketing and PR, we see that we're getting more personalized and more bespoke to our individual lives every day. You know, there is just across every platform, across every industry, across everything that we do, we are more personalized and more individual. And yet in health, we just don't do that. You know, we just, there are so many blockages to that. And I think that we've identified so many of them today. I don't know if there is, you know, an ultimate answer here, but I just think, you know, I give Adam a lot of credit for having his experience and thinking, no, I'm going to create my own brand and I'm going to do my own thing and I'm going to be a voice that communicates to me and people like me. And as you say, the more that that happens as a groundswell at the bottom, the better. But I think that the broader system has to listen to the fact that patients do potentially want to be involved and they do want to have a voice, but it shouldn't be a burden of responsibility, you know, via the consumer hat or whatever else, and an expectation that that's what they need to do and that there is an accountability point that rests with the people who are incumbents in the power dynamic, you know, to bring the patient in and to have that conversation. I guess, it, you know, my sort of close to this conversation would be a call to everyone who's got an opportunity to drive communication and to drive conversation with a patient, and as simple as, you know, introducing themselves and acknowledging the patient by name, all the way through to, you know, adding a new Medicare item number to, you know, the GP sheet to allow people to actually have a conversation and have time. I just want to kind of call out the fact that every person in the system has a responsibility to drive that change and to communicate. But I want to thank you, Joni, today for being the person who was prepared to actually come in and own that and you know, to have the conversation as a representative of communicators in the system more broadly. So thank you so much for your time.
Yeah, it was my pleasure. And yeah, if anything, I hope you just provided a seed for thought. Thank you guys both. I think you're amazing. And as you know, and thank you, Sean, for your insights as well. I think they're critically important to this conversation. So I wish you guys all the best success on this.
Thank you so much.
You're a good egg, Joni. Thank you.
You too. Thanks, guys.
Thanks. Okay, real talk.
Okay, hit us with the real talk.
We never expected that we were going to go to Joni as a PR and communication specialist and solve comms in healthcare.
No, I don't think that was the intention.
We knew that Joni wasn't going to give us the answers to how to make Adam ultimately feel more human.
No.
But what it has done is started a conversation. And what we really wanted to do was take a patient story and really connect it to people who actually live and breathe and work in this system all the time.
Yeah.
And I think we started that conversation.
Fair to say conversation started.
Fair to say the conversation started, and I want it to keep going.
Yeah.
I want to match the next patient story to the next expert who can weigh in, who can share their experience and their insights. But I want to make sure that as we continue to have a conversation about health, that we actually are centered on the patient story and their experience. Because that's just generally not where the focus is.
Yeah.
So I've loved this chat. I think it's opened a lot of doors. I think it's raised a lot of questions, and let's keep the conversation going.
Thank you, Adam. Thank you, Joni. And so with that, we are officially out of segments.
Have we finished our first podcast?
There are. I think we're podcasters
is,
now.
Is this the end of the ep? And yeah. Now we are officially...
Again, I wouldn't say professional, but...
No, we're not professional.
We're done.
We're done.
Look, there's a few things I want.
Mm-hmm.
Thing number one.
Yep.
I love patient stories.
Mm.
I want to hear more of them.
This is a place for patient stories.
We have a website.
We do.
We have a form on our website.
Yes.
If you are a patient, or if you know a patient, or if you work in healthcare,
come on down.
Come on down.
Come on down.
Send us your stories.
Theinpatientpodcast.com.au.
Hit us on the gram.
Totally hit us on the gram.
Don't hit us on the Twitter. We don't tweet.
It's a lot. I don't know about Twitter.
Well, maybe we'll do a Twitter.
We're going to try.
Other than that, see you next time.
Thank you so much for listening.
That's a good point. Other than that, I cannot express my gratitude enough for you putting up with us for the last hour or so.
More than an hour. If you're still here, I am so grateful.
And we have a gift for you.
I'm sending a gift basket.
The gift is Nicole's going to sing her best rendition of...
J-Lo, My Love Don't Cost a Thing. No, I'm not. I'm definitely not. But thank you for staying and thank you for listening and thank you for any further sharing publicity in the lights that you can give this podcast. We really, you know, we're here to share patient stories. We're here to identify opportunities for improvement in care. We're here to challenge the status quo. And we can only do that with help as a community, as a group of people. I think, you know, our conversation with Joni and Adam has just served to highlight that to us today. So thank you for listening. Thank you for being part of this. Like, let's keep the conversation going. I'm psyched.
See you next time.